I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more important books of the season is Conspiracy of Hope, The Truth About Breast Cancer Screening. It's, as Dr. Brian Goldman says, a devastating critique. We've been told that mammograms save lives, yet the science says otherwise. The book's author, Renee Pellerin, joins me now. I'll get her to tell us about the book, about the backstabbing, intrigue, and exploitation. We'll also discuss what people should do. Renee Pellerin is a former television and radio producer with the CBC. She was a documentary producer for Marketplace, as well as The Fifth Estate, the documentary unit at CBC News World, Morningside, and Sunday Morning. She has taught journalism at a number of institutions, such as Ryerson, the National University of Rwanda in Butare, and the University of Regina. The Twitter handle is at Renee Pellerin. This book is published by Goose Lane Editions. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Renee Pellerin. Ms. Pellerin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So as I was telling you just before we started, this is a great book because it's a great achievement to put a book out, but there are many years of reporting that you've done, as well as significant research that you've uncovered over those years. So let's just begin for people listening to us about mammography, and when did that start? When did that become common practice, say, in North America at least?
Well, it became common practice in the 90s, really. That's when Canadian breast screening programs began, with the exception of British Columbia that began in 1988. However, it really got its start in the 1980s, early 1980s, it really got its start in the 1970s after President Nixon declared war on cancer in 1971. And that provided millions of dollars of new money to the National Cancer Institute to develop programs. The American Cancer Society, which had success with a PAP test for cervical cancer, jumped on the bandwagon and proposed a breast screening program to invite 270,000 women to be screened for free for 5 years. And the American Cancer Society really believed that early detection was the key to solving cancer. It also liked the idea of sending this message to people that the American Cancer Society was doing good. And at this point, mammography had been used diagnostically but not for screening, and so a whole bunch of radiologists suddenly had to learn how to read mammograms quickly for screening purposes. Machinery had to be developed. A PR machine was developed to get all these women in, and an industry was born. And when that industry was born, it just steamrolled ahead, and it really, we've never been able to stop it since then. And the important point about it is that when it began, there was scant evidence that screening would actually save lives. Mm-hmm. There was some evidence, but it really wasn't good enough, and there were still many, many questions to answer.
Are there statistics, though, Renee, as to did fewer people die because of this increased screening, say?
Well, so the proponents of screening will tell you that we've reduced mortality by 30%.
Mm-hmm.
That's what some of the research studies have shown us. Other research has shown us that it's not likely to be 30%. It might be way fewer than 30%, and it might not make any difference at all. We know, for instance, in Denmark, where we had a period of time where some of the counties in Denmark had screening, and then only 17 years later, many other counties got screening. And when you compared those two groups and the population, they found that the mortality reduction went down in the areas where there was no screening just as much as it went down in areas where there were screening. So remember, the thing to remember is that at the same time that screening became popular, we were developing new drugs to treat breast cancer. And so those who argue that screening may not be the answer also point to treatment, improvement in treatment being responsible for most of the mortality benefit, if not all of it. So there's been this debate, and it's been going on for 50 years, essentially, whether or not screening saves lives. Now, you know, generally, wisdom, if you want to accept that a 30% reduction in mortality, you also have to think about what that means. That's not a very good test. If a drug only had a 30% success rate, you wouldn't think that that was a very good drug. And so those who are questioning screening say, look, this just isn't really, this really is not good enough.
Yeah. What, so in terms of the mammography itself, you mentioned British Columbia started it. The numbers went up, say, in 1988 because that became policy of the Ministry of Health here in this province.
Yes.
Is that the only way that one can get screened, say?
Well, mammography is the only way that has been actually approved by health authorities as a good screening methodology. Now, we have a new kind of mammography, 3D tomosynthesis mammography, mm-hmm. which is a little bit, can give you a different kind of, more detailed kind of picture. It's very expensive, and in the initial days, it emitted a little bit more radiation, or exposed a woman to a little bit more radiation, so they've been working on that. It's very expensive. It's becoming more popular, but I don't think we're there yet in terms of screening. But I think the big question is it screening? Is that the issue, or is it early detection? And is the point that the smaller you find it, the better? Is that the answer? And maybe it's not. And I think the research that I've been looking at is indicating that we don't know enough about the biology of breast cancer to actually say that early detection is what is saving lives.
So, in terms of what women should do, because I'm sure as this book is being released, and I'm sure as you're traveling to promote it, people will ask you, well, what should we do now? And I'm not just talking about women, but men who have partners and you know, because breast cancer happens in men as well, doesn't it?
Yes, not nearly at the rate that it happens in women. But I'd also like to think that family doctors would be part of this process of what do we do now, because I think family doctors are encouraged to get women to participate in screening. And many doctors have also been hearing this message that early detection saves lives. So I would say, what do we do now? I think a couple of things that are really important. One is we need to talk about it some more. In my book, I outline the ways people have been silenced if they've criticized screening. And there have been arguments and fights about getting better information to women, say, in England, for example. Because generally, when you operate screening programs, you want people to come in. So you don't do a very good job of telling people what the pitfalls are of screening, the harms of screening, the overdiagnosis of breast cancer, and so on. So there's an interest there that says, come for screening. And so women are not given, I think, women are not given really good, solid information. And there's a difference between saying, why should I get screened? And here's what you need to know about getting screened. Those two different approaches. One is kind of insisting that you get screened, or you have to have your head examined. The other says, here's some information if you're interested in screening. If we can have a conversation about how we get the proper information, and so that women and the doctors can have a good conversation, and that women are allowed to make a reasonable choice based on their own preferences, fears, judgment about the harms and benefits of mammography screening.
So what's preventing us from getting the information that we need?
there are so many interests out there that for whom it's important that we keep mammography screening as part of major public policy. Think of all the millions of dollars that are invested in public breast screening programs. Just as a for instance, I think it's $20 million in BC, much more in Ontario, for example, $8 billion in the United States. There's a lot of money in this industry. Right? The Pink Ribbon charities have an interest in keeping women afraid of breast cancer. And that's another question I deal with in the book, is how our fear is probably exaggerated compared to what the actual risk of dying of breast cancer is. So that's what's keeping it going, I think. And it's also just, there's a sincere belief. I don't want to say that all these people who are pushing screening are malevolent in any way. There's a sincere belief that early detection saves lives. It's so intuitive, it's very difficult to get your head around the fact that, you know, maybe in this case, early detection is not the answer. You will still lose women even though you've detected the cancer very early, because we don't necessarily know where it actually started. There's evidence that breast cancer can be systemic before it's even seen in the breast. We just don't know. And there's some research going on at the moment. But until we have like an open, proper public policy discussion, we can't even get to discuss the biology.
Yeah. And you talk in the book to two people who have, through their work, through their research, who've tried to, say, initiate a conversation about all of this and just had their careers and their lives ruined.
You're talking about Cornelia Baines and Anthony Miller?
Yeah. Would you tell us about them and what struggles they've encountered over these past few years?
Mm-hmm. Well, Anthony Miller was head of the Canadian National Cancer Institute research department for a while when he came to Canada in the 1970s. And he became interested in mammogram screening because of what was happening in the United States. And he managed to get a Canadian study going starting in 1980. And this is pretty big. It was 90,000 women across Canada. That is huge, and that's a huge number of people for a study in Canada. And Baines and Miller were sincerely believed at the time that it wasn't a question of whether mammograms worked or not. It was only a question of can we prove it. Mm. And as they collected the data, and they screened 90,000 women for 4 years, as they collected their data, they were starting to see that, you know, it didn't matter if women were under 50 or over 50. It wasn't making any difference to mortality statistics. And when they started to publish the material, they were absolutely vilified mostly by the radiology community. There were vicious letters to editors and journals. They got personal phone calls and emails vilifying them, telling them that they were responsible for murdering women. So, and they've undergone this kind of villainy for the last 25, 30 years. It's been a major issue in their careers.
And when you talk to them, because you do talk to them extensively in the book, and they provide you a lot of their research. As a reporter, when you get this stuff, what's the process in terms of, because you were at the CBC at the time, is that right?
I was at the CBC just at the time I was deciding to write this book, and I was getting ready to leave the CBC, so it was kind of coincidental. So no, I didn't start it while I was at the CBC. I started it right after.
There was a moment, though, when you were there where you said that you have to write a book about this, right?
Yes. It was one of the final stories I was involved in. I was the head of the health content unit for CBC News, and the 25-year update of the Canadian study was published, and I was taken aback by the emotional response to this bit of science that was trying to get the information out there. And that's when I started to ask, what is going on? And then Cornelia Baines and Anthony Miller both received some vicious emails. And I heard about that, and that's when I said, okay, I have to write a book.
Yeah, what strikes me in reading the book is these people in the medical industry, scientists even, they can't seem to have a good debate is the right word, but say a constructive debate about all of this. I mean, there's just so many vested interests that one worries as a citizen, as a health consumer, whether we're getting the right care or not.
Well, and I think the thing that I've learned is that if there's a message, you want to maybe take a look at where the message is coming from. Because most of the people who have kind of independently looked at mammography screening are not people who are specialists in radiology. The radiologists are those who are most vociferous about screening. But those who look at it from an epidemiological point of view, public health point of view, and I'm talking not just Miller and Baines and their research, but the United Services Preventive Services Task Force, United States Preventive Services Task Force, I should say, an independent body looking at the evidence, the Canadian Task Force on Preventive Healthcare, another independent body looking at the evidence, and when they say, look, the evidence that this saves many lives is poor, I kind of think their message is the one that the consumer I'd at least look at in an equal way to the message that we're getting from the breast screening programs and the radiologists, that we must go and get screened, otherwise we're being irresponsible and not taking charge of our own lives.
So the key really is for anyone seeing a doctor, is asking questions, is advocating for themselves. And if the doctor is, doctors have their own interests at times. We've heard this many times in terms of, what sort of prescriptions they're pushing on their patients. I guess the public really should get more informed, shouldn't they, and advocate for their own health care.
Well, I think certainly in terms of making a decision about breast screening, for healthy people to put themselves into that screening program, I think information is the key, and then it's a choice. I'm not saying we have to end screening. Saying it's not a be-all and end-all for every single person. We're getting to a point where we're trying to figure out who is more at risk than another person, so those who are more at risk may want to have more screening, and those at less risk may, if they still want to be screened less often. So there's much discussion to be had about where we go from here, away from this one-size-fits-all, everybody must get screened.
Yeah. You mentioned a moment ago, Renee, about the over-diagnosis of breast screening, and I think that's, I'd like to go back to that for just a sec, because right away when we hear the word cancer, we think it needs to be, it needs to be eradicated, it needs to be cured. Mm-hmm. When it comes to breast cancer, and let's say the amount found in a breast is small, that's not the end of the world for the patient, is it?
Not necessarily, no. But you don't know. You actually don't know. So what's important, on an individual basis, once you've seen something in your breast, then you're going to want to have it out, and you're going to have the surgery, and you're likely going to have some treatment. The problem is that when mammography sees tiny lesions, they see tiny lesions that may be indolent, and they sit there and do nothing for the rest of a woman's life. She may never have a health concern, may never have an issue. The cancer may not grow. And so the research is telling us that this indolent cancer is reasonably common, especially in older women, in breast cancer. And the rates vary from one country to another and so on, but the rate of overdiagnosis and the rate at which those women who have been screened have been diagnosed with a breast cancer that would never have bothered them is about 30%. So that number of women are, so you imagine if they hadn't been screened, they would never know.
Yeah.
But having been screened, they are now subjected to surgery, anxiety, and possible follow-up treatment that includes radiation and possibly chemotherapy. So the problem is you can't tell with that individual woman, no, you don't need to have surgery, or, you know, that we're not there. We can't screen and say, well, you don't need any treatment. But we do know that many, many women are over-treated because of that diagnosis. So, you know, that's the risk. That's the risk you take. If you go looking for something, you might find something that may not bother you. And it's very similar to the prostate cancer issue in men.
Yeah, because there's been talk about whether the PSA test is accurate. And then I guess people have found that a reliance on that. I mean, they do look at PSA tests and mammographies as sort of a vaccine, don't they?
Yeah. And it's funny, some women even describe mammography as a way of not to get cancer, which is completely false, of course. So it's a misleading, you know, you think it's a shield of armor, but it's actually not. And there are women who have clear mammograms and then a year later develop breast cancer. So there's also that aspect of a false security. It's by far not a perfect test. It is an imperfect test. And we rely on it more than we should.
Are there, in the course of writing the book and for people listening to us, I mean, are you in the book talking about what policy changes government should make in terms of how people are screened, how people are treated, say?
Well, I think it's pretty clear in my book that the message is that the policy is not a good one, that the paradigm of early detection is broken, and we need to fix it. Ending screening may not be the answer, mm-hmm. but we need to do a better job of figuring out who needs to be screened. So I think I deal with that possibility, that we get into a place where we can assess risk and determine the risk a little bit more clearly, and also maybe apply in some circumstances a wait and watch process to not just immediately rush women into surgery and so on, but maybe just to monitor them a little bit more closely and there's some of that research going on now as well, of whether or not we need to be so quick with treatment for what we perceive as a deadly disease. So I'm not making a policy recommendation of any kind. That's not my job as somebody researching for this book. But I do believe we have to have a conversation, and I think publicly, we need to question the millions of dollars we're spending on screening, when maybe there's a better way to spend some of that money in terms of cancer research and more personalized screening possibilities.
I want to end on this, but first, in the book, do you talk about mastectomies and how women, say, who, if they're detected to have, say, a small amount of breast cancer, say?
I think, yeah, okay. So yeah. I think you're talking about ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS.
Yeah, and then the other thing I wanted to ask about was, in the news, you hear of celebrities like Angelina Jolie, for example, because of a history of breast cancer in her family, decide to undertake a double mastectomy. Is that preventative at all?
That's interesting. A double mastectomy is not necessarily going to save a woman's life because of our lack of understanding of the biology of breast cancer. It is entirely possible that before it was detected in the breast, it is already somewhere else in the body. So, you know, I think most women think that a mastectomy is going to resolve the issue for them. It's not necessarily true. In Jolie's case, with that particular gene, that genetic trait that runs in families, that's a small number of women. That doesn't apply to very many people. The problem is with the Jolie case, it kind of sent a message that anybody who has family history needs to get genetic testing and so on and so on. The truth is that family history outside of that trait, say you just have one relative in your family who's had breast cancer, not a whole bunch of different relatives, for instance, family history is not the risk factor we actually think it is. It is a risk factor, but it's not nearly as important as we think it is. Age is the biggest risk factor, and after that, other smaller risk factors come behind, like breast density, and obesity is a big factor in postmenopausal women.
I guess the thing that I was thinking about was after the Jolie case. I guess if people everywhere had been told that they had, say, an amount of cancer in their breast, decided, well, let's just get rid of them, if you will.
Well, let me get back to DCIS because I didn't explain it very
well.
Sure. A ductal carcinoma in situ is cancerous cells within the milk ducts, and they have not crossed the membrane and to become invasive into breast tissue. They're confined within milk ducts. And we didn't used to see these things until mammograms showed them to us because you can't feel them. They're very tiny, and sometimes they show up as little white specks in the mammogram, calcium specks. But sometimes they can be quite diffuse. They can be in different areas of the breast. Now, typically, women are treated for DCIS just in the same way they are treated for invasive cancer. So you will have surgery, and if the DCIS is diffuse, if it is occurring in different places in the breast, then the surgical option is often a full mastectomy. And more women are saying, hey, I'm going to have the mastectomy and then that'll be done with it. And then some of them go in and have a double mastectomy. Now, the rate of mastectomies has gone up. It's still small, but it is increasing because that's an option that more and more women are pursuing. And it could be the Jolie effect, but it also could be that they don't want to keep going back and back for more and more surgery, especially if you know, they have DCIS and it's uncertain what will happen. With DCIS, I think the important thing to know is that only a very small number of DCIS cancers, or non-cancers really, will develop into an invasive cancer.
As I hope people listening to this will understand, it's a fascinating book. It's such a compelling story. But beyond that, I think it's an important book that people should read. Congratulations, Renee, on its publication, and good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun to talk to you.
The book is called Conspiracy of Hope: The Truth About Breast Cancer Screening. It's published by Goose Lane. Renee Pellerin, its author, joined me on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.